So I've noticed that there is this particular kind of fluorescent hum that you only hear in laundromats late at night. At least the ones near where I live, anyway. And it makes this this thin, like vibrating sound of a civilization that technically it's still functioning, but it's clearly forgotten why it's still functioning. And I was sitting there last week in a row of plastic chairs that were a shade of orange that shouldn't exist in nature, watching a heavy-duty dryer tumble a single solitary sneaker. And it was making this sound like a heartbeat with a limp, like an irregular heartbeat, I guess. And every time that it hit the glass, it felt like a tiny rubberized protest against the vacuum of the hour. There was a poster I noticed taped to the plexiglass, something about finding your bliss or something of that nature. And it occurred to me then that the amount of effort most people put into being happy is ironically the most exhausting and irritating thing about them. Because it seems to me that in this day and age in our society, we treat joy or happiness like it's a second job. But it's a job where the boss is always watching you, and you get paid in the form of decorative throw pillows and social media engagement. And it's this frantic, desperate sort of labor that you can see in the way people hold their faces in the grocery stores while they're trying to decide which brand of poison is least likely to ruin their lives. So you see this, there's this low-level panic behind the eyes, and there's this fear that if the mask, the doing great mask, slips even for a second, the whole infrastructure of their personality might just dissolve in a puddle of slush right there in the dairy aisle. Now, I'm not talking about being depressed here. That's its own separate thing. This is different. This is the functional weight of clarity, of being awake and observant. I think this is the realization that most of the things that we're told that'll save us, you know, like the so-called career milestones, you know, the wellness retreats, the master classes taught by these online gurus or whatnot. These things are all just, they're different ways of decorating a room that's nonetheless slowly filling up with carbon monoxide. So you spend several hours or whatever rearranging the furniture and making sure the feng shui is perfect while the oxygen is getting thinner in there. So Eric Wilson wrote about this in his book, which we'll talk a little bit more about later. And he called this, he had a name for this, generative melancholy. So this is the idea that there's a certain kind of truth that you can only see when you're not blinded by the glare of forced optimism, you know. Good old toxic positivity. So it's like when the power goes out in the city during a storm at night, and the street lights go dark, and voila, you can see the stars. But on the other hand, you also, it makes you realize how much of your daily life is being powered by artificial light and, you know, expensive wiring. And you awake to the fact that so much of your contentment is just, really, it's just a steady supply of electricity and all these endless distractions. I find it kind of funny that we've become, it seems like we've become allergic to the dark and silence. Not, this isn't the scary kind of dark, the cinematic dark with all the monsters. I'm talking about the silent, the mundane dark. So this is the part of the day where nothing's happening. No one's texting you or emailing you or whatever, and you're just a person existing in a plastic orange chair in a laundromat. And this is usually the moment where people, they try to kill it with by scrolling and eating a snack or what have you, because that's when you realize that you don't actually like the person sitting in the chair very much. Or maybe you do, but you realize that you're both just, you're very tired, profoundly tired of pretending that the journey is going somewhere. So Oliver Berkman wrote about what he called, he had this concept called the negative path, which is the suggestion that the more you try to avoid all this uncomfortable stuff, like the boredom or the fact that your lower back feels like it's made of old plied wood, the more you try to ignore these things, the more power they have over you. So we spend our entire lives building these elaborate fortresses of positivity just to keep out a breeze that wouldn't actually kill us if we just let it blow through the house. But because we're terrified of the draft, we suffocate. I think there's actually a certain kind of respectability in just being a mess, just accepting it. It's a kind of serene, I guess, functional mess that shows up for work on time and pays the bills, and it understands that the good vibes only sign in the break room is actually more of a threat than anything actually good. And it's a demand for emotional compliance. It's basically the company telling you that your honesty is a liability to the quarterly earnings. When I think about the people who seem genuinely, effortlessly happy, I can't help but to have the suspicion that they're mostly just very good at forgetting things. I mean, maybe they have a very short memory. And they seem to have this talent for ignoring the hum of the fluorescent lights. But for the rest of us, poor souls, the ones that notice the limp in the dryer and the way the air feels kind of hollow in a crowded room, I think there's a different kind of survival happening. It isn't about finding an antidote. It's about realizing that the poison is actually just it. It's just the atmosphere. And, you know, you might as well just learn how to breathe it without coughing so much. I don't know about you, but I have noticed that there's a kind of exhaustion that comes from having to be on for people who don't actually really matter to you. And we all got to do this to some degree. So a friend of mine was playing at a networking event a few months ago, and he asked me to attend for some moral support. And I agreed. And it was one of those places that's filled with lukewarm white wine and people who describe themselves as, passionate about things like cloud-based data solutions and the sort. And it seemed that everyone had this terrifyingly fixed expression of a smile that doesn't quite reach the eyes, if you know what I mean. It's a smile that it just sits on the mouth like a hostage. Let's just leave it at that. If you ever look closely at someone who's been pretending to be enthusiastic about something for like 4 hours, you can usually see the micro cracks in the porcelain. I mean, they're spent. Because there is a hell of a toll in maintaining this performance. But, you know, we do it because the alternative, being a person with a neutral face who just wants to go home and sit in the silence and in the dark, that person is seen as a professional red flag. Happiness has been, I think it's been at this stage of the game, it's been industrialized and turned into a just another commodity that you have to produce to stay employable. So it's not enough just to do your job anymore. Now you have to love the job. You have to be aligned with the mission. And if you aren't, then you're labeled as toxic. This is just a nicer way of saying that your lack of delusion is making everyone else uncomfortable. You know, when I think about the good vibes only crowd, it seems to me that they're actually the ones who are the most likely to snap in a traffic jam or whatever. I mean, they spend so much time suppressing the natural, healthy questioning of existence that when it finally leaks out in some way, in some incident, it comes out sideways. Usually it's directed at, unfortunately, a retail worker or someone, someone in the service industry. It's almost like they've built this internal dam out of affirmations and TED Talks and all that stuff. But, you know, water still finds a way, right? And I think if you're in that mindset, the more that you insist on all the light and the faux positivity, the more intense the shadows are going to be when they finally do show up. So Oliver Berkman mentions this idea that the constant pursuit of security that we have in our society, you know, this forced happiness that we all do, this is what makes us feel insecure and miserable. So it's kind of like trying to hold a handful of sand. So the harder you squeeze, the faster it's going to disappear. And I think most people they're squeezing so hard that their knuckles are white. And they're terrified that if they stop striving, if they stop trying to perfect everything, they'll stop existing entirely. Or worse, maybe they'll realize that they're just a collection of habits in a rented meat suit. And then at that point comes the full-on existential meltdown. Anyway, I left that event early, not surprisingly. And I stood on the sidewalk for a bit, watching the traffic. And there was a guy across the street trying to scrape a parking ticket off his windshield with what looked like a credit card. Needless to say, he didn't look very happy. But that was the only refreshing thing I'd seen all evening, because it was reality. It was a moment of authenticity. I mean, he wasn't putting on any kind of act. He was just a guy in the rain experiencing the objective reality of a shitty night. I think it's actually relieving if you can admit that things are a bit of a disaster. Not necessarily a full-on catastrophe, just more like a slow-motion mundane mess. So, you know, it's the difference between trying to fix a leaky faucet with your bare hands and just putting a bucket under it and going to bed. I mean, the drip is still there, of course, and the problem isn't solved, but you've stopped fighting the fact that it's dripping. Acceptance. Society so badly wants us to believe that every single negative emotion is a problem that needs to be solved. It's like a knot to be untied. But, you know, some knots are just part of the rope, and if you untie them, then the whole thing comes apart. And I think that's what people are actually afraid of. They're not really afraid of being sad. I mean, sadness is just a natural part of life. They're afraid that their sadness is the only thing that's actually real about them. And that is a disturbing thought, understandably. So Eric Wilson, who wrote the book Against Happiness in Praise of Melancholy, he has this theory that we're essentially lobotomizing our culture by being so obsessed with the bright side, I guess. So his term, generative melancholy, it's a fancy way of saying that nothing interesting ever happens in a state of perfect contentment. So if you're completely satisfied, right, you have little reason to build anything or say anything substantial or even move for that matter, because contentment is like, it's basically like a flat line. It's a dead end. The other day, I was looking at a set of old leather-bound books in a thrift store. You know, these are the ones with that damp, musty smell. And I opened one of them, and a pressed flower fell out of it. And I picked it up, and it was very brittle and very ancient-looking. And it looked like it would turn into dust if I so much as breathed too hard on it. It was kind of like a tiny preserved piece of someone's sadness from 50 years ago or whenever it was. And yet, somehow, it still felt more alive than any, I guess, inspirational quote post that I've seen in a while. I think there's a reason nobody writes a masterpiece about a really great salad. Good art, it's almost always a byproduct of things going at least slightly wrong. Usually things going very wrong. So it's really about friction. And I think it's about the friction of existing in this world that no matter how beautiful it might be, it's constantly chipping away at you in one way or another. And we do live in a state of entropy, after all. You know, the paintings, for example, that actually stop you in your tracks, they're not typically Pollyanna, if you know what I mean. I see it like it's evidence that someone else was awake in the dark too. But we have been convinced that the dark is a waste of time, and there's nothing there to be found but fear and, you know, loneliness and all that stuff. Because, you know, in our society, if we're not constantly producing or consuming, then I guess we're just rotting, right? So what do? We try to fill that void with noise. And we buy things to fill the silence. And then we buy things to help us manage the stress of having too many things, and it just turns into this endless recursive loop of distraction. I remember this one time some years back, I was staying in a cabin and there was no cell service, no internet, and at first, not going to lie, it was pretty rough. Because at first I was reaching for my pocket, looking for some I guess, phantom vibration that wasn't there. But after a day or so, the withdrawal symptoms stopped, and it was replaced by this vast, hollow quiet. Now, I wouldn't say it was exactly peaceful. It was actually kind of uncomfortable, honestly. And this is the void that Wilson talks about in his book. I think when you stop running, that's when you realize the void isn't something to be filled. The void is actually a space where you finally have to reckon with yourself. And it ain't pretty. Because you realize that most of your personality consists of a series of reactions to external stimuli. And without all that noise, that constant distraction, you're basically just a stranger in a room. And that is a terrifying realization for most people. Because I think most people would rather be frantically unhappy than quietly empty. So Wilson argues that the melancholic person is the one, well, they're the one who actually preserves the soul of a culture, because they're the ones who refuse to accept the hollow substitutes. They're the ones who more or less insist on the gravity of things. And when everyone else is, I guess, floating away on, you know, the clouds of toxic positivity, the melancholic is like an anchor, because they're the ones who remember that we're finite, and that, you know, things are temporary, things break. And that every so-called new and improved product is just really another way of delaying the inevitable. And all this distraction is just another way of delaying the inevitable. And that our lives are just, you know, we're absolutely inundated with denial. And I think there is a dignity in the refusal to be cheered up by false positivity. It's not, you know, this isn't about being a killjoy here. It's about being a witness, where you're looking at that brittle flower in the book and acknowledging that it's beautiful because it died, and not because it's trying to pretend it's still in bloom. And, you know, in our society, we are so busy trying to stay in bloom all the time. And I think we've forgotten how to be the soil. And we're forgetting that the most generative thing in the world is actually the dirt. So I have a drawer in my kitchen that I try not to open too fast, because it's mostly full of, let's call it, it's mostly full of optimism that I couldn't afford. So there's a pedometer in there from, I guess, 2018, and there's a book on learning Japanese that I only got like 5 or 10 pages into. And it's kind of like a cemetery for the imaginary person I keep trying to outsource my life to. So Oliver Berkman wrote the book called The Antidote: Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. And he has a name for this. It's the efficiency trap. That's what he calls it. So it's this idea that if we just find the right system or the right app, or I guess the right mindset, that we can finally get on top of everything. We think we can conquer our finitude, but the truth is, the more efficient you get, the more the world just fills your plate with more demands. And I think there's a relief, a profound relief in it, just admitting that you're never going to get your shit fully together. I mean, not really. You're always going to be a little behind in some way, a little tired, probably a lot tired. You're probably always going to be inwardly baffled about what the hell you're even doing here. So Berkman's negative path concept, it's not about failing. It's about recognizing that failure is, that's more or less the baseline. That's really one of the fundamentals of the human condition. So the other day, I noticed this one-legged pigeon pecking at a pizza crust on the sidewalk. Yeah, kind of sad. And but I also noticed that, that bird definitely had no 5-year plan. I mean, it wasn't trying to optimize its life, or I guess become a successful pigeon. It was just a pigeon dealing with reality. We are taught to believe that acceptance equals defeat. But when you look straight at your own inevitable death and you ask, all right, now what? That, I think that actually takes a certain nerve. Most of life, it's just going to involve waiting for the kettle to boil, or inching along in traffic anyway. And the toxically positive thinking industry wants every single moment to be a gift. And you're supposed to acknowledge that constantly. And look, from a certain perspective, every moment is a gift. I understand that. But most of the time, it's just the moment tends to be another mundane weekday with no lessons, no transformation, no grand epiphanies, what have you. It's just, there's just a dullness in the moment. And I think it's okay to just acknowledge that and sit with that. I think when we stop trying to force everything to be meaningful and purposeful all the time, the world, it stops feeling like a, I guess, a classroom. And it starts looking more like a landscape. All this this gaslighting pressure for you to be happy, I think it really gets claustrophobic after a while. But you know, when you give yourself permission to be bored, uninspired, maybe even, dare I say, sad, you know, when you just let yourself just feel the feelings, I think the walls start to move back. And you stop hunting for some cure, because the disease turns out to be the terrain itself. Eventually, you quit staring at the map and you just start walking, even if you're limping. I don't know. maybe you've noticed where you live that they've started putting these metal armrests on public benches so that people can't lie down on them. And this is called hostile architecture. And it's kind of like a passive aggressive way of saying, just keep moving. Don't get too comfortable or too settled. Don't relax too much. Our cities, you know, they're not really built for people to just exist. They're built for commerce, transactions. And then you also have out in the suburbs, you've got the sound of, you know, 25 lawnmowers buzzing at the same time. And every single one of them is like a small fortress of property maintenance. So somewhere along the line, community was traded for the sterile security of a Ring doorbell. And it's an impressive system, I guess, efficiency-wise, in some ways. I mean, I don't trust those things at all because of the surveillance state. And, you know, now we've got self-checkout lanes and the high-speed internet, of course, and the delivery services of every kind. So you can go an entire week without ever speaking to another human being now. And we call this convenience. But I think sometimes it feels like a slow motion exile. And our apps, they're not much different from those benches because they're digital hostile architecture. And they, you know, they turn our dread and our empty moments into a neat little data points. You know, at this stage of the game, loneliness isn't really a personal failure anymore. It's more a failure of a system that mostly just cares about your usefulness. And I think that once you realize or recognize those armrests for what they are, you stop wondering why your back hurts. And there's a kind of liberation in realizing this world was never designed with your comfort in mind. You know, by and large, I think we're obsessed with endings and purpose. And we're always hoping that the functional part of being melancholic, eventually it'll lead to some breakthrough moment where the world finally starts sounding like a symphony or something magical. But it doesn't really work that way, does it? Because unfortunately, there's no gold medal waiting at the end of the path. You're still in the same room with the same, I guess, that same dull ache in your chest. And the only real change that's happening is that you finally stop bargaining. So Wilson's void and Berkman's finitude aren't really, I don't think they're really supposed to be destinations. I would think of them as just, I guess, the weather. Once you stop constantly checking the forecast for a sunny day, you just get used to the clouds, the rain. Sometimes you even notice the way the pavement reflects the streetlights at night. It's not exactly joy, but there's a kind of clarity in that. And you know, if there is no finish line, well, then I guess you can stop running. You can just be a person standing in a kitchen or wherever, realizing that being tired and alone, it doesn't always have to be an emergency. It's just, you know, part of the deal. Part of our fundamental part of our condition. Now, I'm not trying to offer an antidote here. I'm not gonna tell you to go chase the light, obviously. I'm just gonna sit here a while. I think sometimes, you know, it's enough just to be a functional, observant, aware mess in a world that seems to be terrified of its own shadow. And, you know, the hum, it's really not so bad once you stop trying to shut it off, block it out, you know. Well, I guess that's all I've got on that topic today. As I always say, thanks for listening.